This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 11th of December, on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello, and a very warm welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. This week, we're swinging between two recent events on opposite sides of the world, the Business of Design Week in Hong Kong and Design Miami in Miami. Our trusty bureau chiefs, Liv Lewichnik and Aisha Spears, were in respective attendance and have brought us back a host of interesting reports and voices from the talks, shows and parties too. Coming up in the show, Liv Lewichnik weaves her way amongst the hefty Danish design contingent in Hong Kong, set to move into the Asian market.
Asia is a huge market for Danish design, and it should be bigger. It's very difficult for a small country to penetrate the Asian market. The way you do business in the design world in Scandinavia and the way it's done in Asia is quite different.
Liv also sits down with Ulrich Gardedue, CEO of Georg Jensen, to find out what the future is for the brand following its recent acquisition by InvestCorp.
I'm sure that InvestCorp have invested in Georg Jensen because of our strong design DNA and our incredible design heritage.
More on that shortly. Plus, Aisha Spears brings us her highlights from the rich and famous that descended for the design shows and pool parties over in Miami. And Liv Lewichnik gets busy at Detour, the Business of Design fringe event over in Hong Kong too. That's all to come over the next hour here on Section D. We begin our journey this week in Hong Kong. The Business of Design Week has taken place in the city each December since 2002, consisting of a week of talks and seminars on design and the business aspects of the design industry. Organised and hosted by the Hong Kong Design Centre, each year it partners with a different country. They've worked their way through the UK, Italy, France and the Netherlands, but this year settled on Denmark. The Danes came out in force, keen to talk about their heritage, but also their future too. Our Hong Kong bureau chief, Liv Lewichnik, went along to find out what the Hong Kong design crowd might learn from Danish design, and vice versa.
The sound of Lego pieces scratching against each other is familiar to most Scandinavians. The Danish toy has become so ubiquitous in playrooms around the world that it today is displayed as part of Denmark's stable of great, functional, beautiful design. These Lego pieces are here for the visitors to Business of Design Week, a design fest held every year in Hong Kong. Denmark is partner country of the 2012 edition of Business of Design. Nille Juel Sørensen is CEO of the Danish Design Centre, which has brought Danish designers to the city for the event.
Asia is a huge market for Danish design, and it should be bigger. It's very difficult for a small country to penetrate the Asian market, and also because I think the way you do business in the design world in Scandinavia and the way it's done in Asia is quite different. So you could say that Hong Kong is a fantastic entrance to the Asian market. So that's why we even have huge brands like Georg Jensen and Bang & Olufsen and Fritz Hansen here, because they want to use it as a sort of a springboard into Asia.
As in any other sector, designers are eyeing the lucrative Chinese market, hoping to expand their brands into a country where Scandinavian design is becoming more sought after. As the CEO of Fritz Hansen, Jakob Holm, says though, his brand is keen on breaking into China in a big way, but we'll make sure to stay true to Fritz Hansen's Danish design heritage, no matter what.
The reason why we have established right now is because we believe that the Chinese market is slowly opening up to our kind of design. This will not be a quick fix and a quick win. On the contrary, it will be a long fight. We realize that with the kind of design from Scandinavia that we come with, it's a storytelling thing. We need to start with Adam and Eve and tell the entire spell of where we come from and how we think. But we believe that the commercial market is opening up. And we think there is a long-term investment in first-tier cities as Shanghai and Beijing. The strategy of Fortensen is to continue with our own design DNA. And I'm sorry to say, we will not adapt to Chinese design, having dragon heads or gold-plated chairs as such. But obviously, we need to make sure that we tell the story in a way whereby it can be understood in China. And we realize that that Danish design and Fritzensen design will always be a niche in the Chinese market. But I think there is room for a niche, and I think there is room for people that are realizing from the fact that they are becoming more and more globalized, that they are traveling much more extensively, that some people, as we see other places around the world, for some reason attach themselves to a more minimalistic, functionalistic approach to design.
Business of design isn't just for the big designers and global brands, though. It brings together entrepreneurs who want to find the design ideas they can turn into businesses, the designers who want to understand the business side of design, and of course, lots and lots of design students. Among the 100,000 people who attended this year from across Asia, all were interested in attending the lectures and seminars on how to build a brand or how to turn innovation into cash. One of the speakers talking to a full-seated auditorium is Johannes Torp, creative director of Danish design brand Bang & Olufsen.
The really interesting part here is that most other design weeks does never mention the word business. It's just like design, 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 and you know, this designer made a new chair. Oh my God, it's a new chair. This is amazing. And yeah, well, there's many artists to be seated in the world, so you should make many chairs. But on the other hand, if you don't have a business behind, not the ass, but behind the chair, and you know why you make another chair, then you shouldn't do one, because I think it's a globalized world of completely insane consumption of products and things. And I really prefer to do my design through a business model and to understanding what is the business case before. And many people and many clients get very, you know, surprised about this. They're like, really? Are you interested in the business? And I was like, of course I am. Because if I don't take part of your business, you will not sell my product. And if you don't sell my product, I will not make any money in the end. So yeah, you really have to take this very seriously. And that is what I think this design community and design show in Hong Kong is doing, thinking about the business case as well. How do you actually make a business out of it?
But it's not all business talk at Business of Design. Denmark was specifically invited to the fair because of its expertise in designing for the social good, something Hong Kong and the region can learn from. William Toh works for Hong Kong Design Center, which organizes Business of Design.
Denmark has a very long history in design culture, and they have always been very influential, and some of their products are iconic in the design world. But the past decades, Denmark has been leading the world in applying design on social welfare and society improvement. So we thought we have a lot to learn from our partner this year, because especially on social design in this part of the world, so we picked Denmark to work with.
Danish designer Bo Linnemann, founder of design agency ContraPunkt, which has worked on graphic design for clients such as IKEA and Carlsberg, is set on the idea of making places better to live in. He wants to launch a typeface institute that makes communication between East and West that much easier.
For about 30 years, I've been working intensely with type design. And what I do is that I develop brand typefaces for big brands to enable them to actually express their identity through any message. So you have an exclusive typeface for a certain brand or a company. I've noticed during all these years that in the West, most designers, even really skilled graphic designers, they don't know about how to handle bilingual communication. And they have no knowledge about Eastern typefaces and Eastern language as such. And the same goes for designers here. They don't have much understanding and much knowledge about our Western typefaces and how we use them, what they tell, and all this. So I am setting up now a small research unit that are called Typasia, which is a small unit in our company that explores how to we can actually deal with bilingual communication, Chinese Western, Chinese English, and how we can actually develop typefaces, both in Western and Eastern, that are actually talking with the same tongue, though they are different languages.
Business of Design Week may be over for this year, but with designers such as Bo Linneman setting up a local research institute and happy fairgoers talking about what they've heard in speeches and seminars over the past few days, we're sure to see a lasting impact on the local design community in Hong Kong and perhaps even further afield. For after all, events such as Business of Design is all about bringing people together and inspiring new ideas. The Danish Design Centre's Nille Juel Sørensen again.
I see Hong Kong Business of Design Week as a platform for making businesses. But it's also it's not just a week event. It's a long-lasting relationship. So we started it a year ago, and I can see there's more and more Danes connecting to Hong Kong now. A lot of Hong Kong people connecting to Denmark. And I think that's what we have to keep going and nurse it, because I think it's so important.
For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levichnik.
Thank you very much, Liv. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24, where we're swinging between the Business of Design Week in Hong Kong and Design Miami over in Miami. This year, the Danes were the partner country for the Business of Design Week, and one Danish company in hot demand was Georg Jensen. Bahraini investment house Investcor purchased the Danish luxury brand for 108 million euros last month. The Copenhagen-based luxury jewellery, watches and silverware maker, founded in 1904, today has 94 shops worldwide and is hoping that the new owners will help the brand launch big in new markets such as China. Liv Levichnik sat down with Georg Jensen's CEO, Ulrik Garde-Due, to talk about the company's future.
Well, we have the past 5 years been working on what is most important in my point of view when you reposition a brand, and it's the product. So we have been very carefully within each of our product segments, whether it's being jewelry, watches or our home collection, been working carefully on the price pyramids and making sure that we have sufficiently of innovative products to create the excitement out with the end consumer. Then we have been working on our new retail store format and have created a beautiful flagship store concept where you really feel like walking into a Danish home when you walk into one of our 100 stores globally. It's sleek, elegant, yet has a cozy and warm and exclusive feeling. For 5 years now, I've been working on the repositioning of the company to energize and revitalize the brand. A sleepy old beauty, and we have really seen a new customer coming through our doors who appreciates the design language from Denmark, the strong design DNA we have, and the incredible heritage we have, which is expressed in our products. And as you know, we were just bought by Investcorp, who have a very strong track record with brand turnarounds. They have been involved in both Tiffany and Gucci. And I think with Investcorp and their international experience within the luxury consumer goods segment, as well as the way they, from a funding point of view, is set up, can be a terrific muscle and partner for us to take the brand to the next level.
And what about the new owners? Are they introducing a lot of changes then?
It's still early days. You know, we were only sold a little more than a month ago. We already had our first strategic session last week, which was very exciting. It's for sure that Investcorp have very high ambitions for Georg Jensen, which we are thrilled about, and they are really going to give us the support to take us to the next level. We have a great new board with very experienced people on board, also coming from the luxury industry, and with a very international mindset and knowledge of how the consumer in the different regions are reacting towards a luxury lifestyle brand.
How do you stay true to the heritage of the brand when you have foreign owners?
Well, I'm sure that Investcorp have invested in Georg Jensen because of our strong design DNA and our incredible design heritage, and have seen a real possibility of expanding that unique design DNA which we stand for, which, you know, integrates innovative design with simplicity, understated elegance, and true craftsmanship and quality. And those assets which we are sitting on, Invescorp agrees with us in that the consumer is exactly looking for those assets when they go out and invest in luxury products. You know, I think the consumer out there is becoming more and more difficult to serve and more spoiled. It's a fierce competition out there in the market. But if you have the right authentic design and the right quality price ratio in a product, there's still a lot of great consumers out there who will appreciate our products.
If we can talk about your new markets and the sort of the strategies that you're using to capture those, you know, a new audience or new consumers for the brand.
We have for many years been represented in the Greater China countries. So we have a strong market share in both countries like Taiwan and Hong Kong, and have seen that the Chinese consumer very much understands the products we are doing and are attracted to our unique design language. We now have to make a strategy for mainland China, where we are just about to enter in a new way, and Invescorp with their experience is going to help us doing so. But obviously we see a big opportunity for the mainland Chinese consumers, both shopping in mainland China but also when they travel abroad.
And any other markets that you're looking at and that will become increasingly important in the years to come?
Well, we are going to continuously build on our main market, being Japan and, as I mentioned, Taiwan, Hong Kong. Australia is a big market for us, and we'll continue developing our business there. But even in our neighboring countries in the northern part of Europe, I still think we have a big expansion possibility, this being both Scandinavia, Germany, England, and also some of the southern part of Europe countries.
Are you seeing, you know, any interesting design trends or, you know, anything interesting to look at in terms of design emerging from a place like Hong Kong or the region?
Well, I think the consumer in this part of the world gets more and more sophisticated and understands a greater and greater extent the beauty in the simplicity in design, which is exactly what we stand for. However, I also see the consumer here being very demanding in terms of quality and in terms of new ways of using mix of materials, which I think we can learn from. And the craftsmanship in this part of the world has such a great history also. So if we can merge that with our design DNA, it could be a great mix of experiences.
And if we look at the near future, in the next 5 years or so, what are your hopes for the brand? Where would you like it to be in 5 years' time or 10 years' time?
I would hope that much more people appreciate what Danish design and luxury lifestyle is about, and really understand the authenticity in our design language and in our unique craftsmanship, and link that to the assets which we are sitting on in Scandinavia, hopefully making everybody's life better.
That was Georg Jensen, CEO Ulrich Garde-Due, with our Hong Kong Bureau Chief Liv Lewicznik at the Business of Design Week in Hong Kong there. Still to come on Section D, we'll be hitting the design exhibition Detour, which takes place concurrently with the Business of Design Week. And then we'll be jetting off to Miami for Design Miami, where our New York Bureau Chief will be filling us in on all the news there. But before that, a short break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
This Christmas, Monocle 24 is packing its earmuffs, mittens, sticks, and skis as we head up the Alps to sunny St. Moritz for a winter retreat. we'll be bringing you a Christmas stocking full of shows, including The Briefing, Midori House, and The Review. So join our editors and their guests for a festive spree of friends and family, debate and discussion, with plenty of mulled wine, from Boxing Day all the way to New Year's Day 2013, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Section D, where we're tearing through the business of Design Week in Hong Kong before heading over to Design Miami. Away from the Hong Kong Design Centre, we turn to Detour, the design and arts festival held alongside the business of Design Week. Here's Monocle's Liv Lewicznik to tell us more.
Though there's still plenty to be done, Hong Kong is moving in the right direction when it comes to raising the bar on the city's design output. The not-for-profit Ambassadors of Design organises the two-week design event Detour, which sets out to challenge perceptions on what design and art is here. Jihan Chu sits on the Ambassadors of Design board and is in charge of Detour's programming.
Detour 2012 is a milestone year for Detour, and really for Ambassadors of Design. In previous years, the festival was less focused in its curatorial content. And what we really wanted to do this year is raise the bar in how we present art and design in Hong Kong. Hong Kong is at a really critical point in its cultural development, where there are, you know, there's finally, you know, starting to be a good volume of creative activity in terms of festivals, in terms of events. But what we really need to see now is more sophisticated events, more tightly curated, more focused content, and a higher level of critical dialogue around some of the issues, both socially, both aesthetically, and also internationally, having a good balance of both local content and international content. Right now, Hong Kong is at an interesting time, and it's a critical time because it's in its adolescence culturally. And when I say culturally, it's not to, that's not to discount any other types of, you know, culture which are longstanding, you know, Chinese culture. When I say culture, I'm really referring to contemporary urban culture in terms of the arts and design, etc. In that sense, it's a very, very critical time. People are moving here, are flocking here to start their kind of entrepreneurial businesses, which are great and, you know, design related, product related, what have you. It's great. So 2012 is important because it's the first time we issued an international call for a curator, and we got that in spades from a curatorial team, John Bella from Rebar and Justine Topfer, both based out of San Francisco, and partnering them with Aiden Lee, who is based here in Hong Kong. He's our Hong Kong creative director. And so the big difference for 2012 is that we have what we feel is a very, very kind of comprehensive and ideally, you know, sophisticated curatorial proposition for what this festival is. In previous years, it was more about kind of share and share alike. And in 2012, we are trying to put an idea out there, and we're trying to get people to think about it. And that idea is, what is public space? How do we use public space? Who does public space belong to? Does it really belong to the public? And how do we kind of negotiate that as citizens of Hong Kong, as an audience in Hong Kong, as designers and creatives in Hong Kong?
Looking at public space and how it's used is a topical issue for Hong Kong, a city that seems to get denser by the year and where any kind of space, public or private, comes with an astronomical price tag attached to it. The local government is starting to finally listen to the people who are advocating greater rights for the city's citizens. Detour is a case in point. This year, the festival's exhibition is held at the former police station, a heritage building for the first time given over to the public in the busy Wan Chai district. Hong Kong designer and architect Tim Lee is showing his installation of folding chairs on the police station's balcony.
When you come out from the entrance, there's nothing. I want people to get out to the balcony, balcony quoted, but it's not only a balcony, but a lawn that is green, that is in Hong Kong context, lawn are not supposed to be stepped on, to walk on, but I want to break that rule, and then you come into the balcony and it becomes a park, maybe, but it's a covered area, and you're looking over to a really busy Gloucester Road, and on the two sides I put the folding beds. Those folding beds are converted from a traditional one on the structure, but they're still foldable like the traditional one. But the pattern of it is still the white, blue, and red typical color. But I changed the pattern as a kind of an evolvement from the traditional one.
Walking around the old police station through the former crime investigation rooms, you come across exhibits of delicate jewelry, models of utopian cities, a life-sized doll that beams lasers. An entire room has been taken over by a local farming group showing off the vegetables they grow here to pleasant music in the background. In another, you find Polaroids of Hong Kong in a collage on the wall. Outside, large-scale installations have taken over the parking lot. Designers Andrew Kudles from San Francisco and Jordanian-Canadian Riyad Joka have created the Shell Star Pavilion, a fantastical plastic structure under which visitors, in theory, should be able to meet. Riyad Joka.
I mean, unfortunately, we have this barrier here set by the Hong Kong government officials. It's partly due to some issues, internal issues with the organization, but also partly due to some bureaucracy from the government. I mean, it's a safe structure. We've been working underneath it for an entire week at least. We're quite sure of its safety to the public. Unfortunately, because it's an unusual design, people tend to be a bit scared in Hong Kong about these things. So we designed the structure to be accommodating for people inside of it. Unfortunately, due to these restrictions that we faced, and it was sort of a last minute decision that they sort of banned people from coming inside because, and you know, like it's a bit of a shame because, you know, we're trying to overcome these restrictions by having people inside. It's actually my fourth month in Hong Kong, and Andrew, it's his first time building something in Hong Kong, so it was a good collaboration. It was sort of an eye opener to what kind of restrictions or bureaucracy you might face. I mean, I think Hong Kong is up and coming in terms of allowing the West to come and invest in ideas and by working here, sort of collaborating with the locals. Hong Kong is sort of the gate to the East, as they say, and I feel from the local point of view, it's very much so, but you know, there's still this sort of fear that, you know, to innovate or to step outside of conformity. And you know, I think it's slowly happening, but interventions like this might sort of raise awareness to this issue, and hopefully we'll get over that soon. So I hope it's not my last project here, and so does Andrew. Andrew loves Hong Kong, and you know, he really wants to come back and create something new here.
It's ironic that the Hong Kong government should be so overbearing that it forbids detour goers from using the installations the way they should, as public spaces. The ban in a way summarizes the conservative nature of Hong Kong and the city's reluctance to letting young designers with new ideas introduce new concepts to people here. But at least it's a good start to show off both local and international designers and artists and hopefully get the debate on the use of public space going. For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levichnik.
Thank you very much, Liv. You're listening to Section D, where we've been tackling the annual Business of Design Week in Hong Kong. But it's time now to pack our bags and board a flight to the sunny southeast coast state of Florida, where the other half of the design world has been hanging out. Yes, we're off to Miami, where the 8th Design Miami brought together a stellar cast of galleries, designers and even celebrities for a host of exhibitions, talks and of course parties too. Aisha Spears, our New York Bureau Chief, was there to soak it all up, lucky thing. And we'll be hearing from her shortly. But first, we dropped by the studio of one of Japan's greatest designers, Kenya Hara, the creative director of Muji, to hear about an unusual project he was working on, ready to unveil at Miami. It's a series of architect-designed dog kennels, fittingly called Architecture for Dogs.
So can I just ask you, did you choose the architects and designers based on their love of dogs? Are they all dog owners?
For a start, I found it important to send the theme of dog architecture to top-class architects, whose works and concepts are well-known worldwide, regardless of if they like dogs or not. Young architects could have done the job, but this is only so in terms of creativity. But if you ask unique questions to architects you know well in terms of their past works and concepts, you can enjoy seeing their approach to the assignment. Therefore, the architects had to be well recognized, and also my close friends, so that my unconventional project could be approved.
I was interested in the fact that people will be able to download the blueprints and build these houses for themselves. It seems to be quite popular in the design world at the moment. Do you think that's the way forward?
The fact that you can download the blueprint is a characteristic of the modern internet age. Traditionally, an architectural project has a set structure. One plan produces one building. I made it download free since I thought it would be interesting if multiple identical buildings popped up across the world simultaneously.
Why do you think dogs haven't been catered for before?
Well, we've had kennels, I guess. But if you give it a thought, humans are the only creatures that has adapted to the environment to their own needs. Humans adapt their surrounding environment to their standard or scale. You could say that dogs are forced to adjust themselves to a human living environment. So you might think there could be a problem there.
Do you think the architects and designers learnt anything from designing for dogs that they might then apply to other buildings?
I'm not the best person to answer that. The architects can answer that question. I'm not too sure what they learned from this project, but I guess they're interested in how dogs responded to their works.
There's a very illustrious list of designers and architects here. Was it easy to persuade them to participate in this project?
Most architects accepted my offer with no problem since they know that I do this sort of unique work occasionally. I know the Japanese designers especially well, so that we had no problem in that regard.
That was Ken Yahara in his studio in Tokyo with Fiona Wilson, our bureau chief there. He was introducing us to the Architecture for Dogs project last month. Aisha Spears caught up with Hara in Miami, together with Anne Ishii of Imprint Venture Labs, as well as the Dutch architects MVR DV, who were responsible for one of the Mutt houses.
I don't know where about Miami, but I'm very happy to be here, because the feeling is not so serious. Né? So if I launch this exhibition in Europe, the condition is more tight and more serious and more crowded, so feeling. But in Miami, the atmosphere is very calm. So I like the idea of Toraf, so Suzuno-san's idea. So Toraf uses the old clothes of the dog owners. The dog loves the smell of the owners. If we research the action of dogs, dog always sitting on the old sweater, the old clothes of the owner, because they love the smell of the owner. We use the old clothes to make an architecture for dogs. Dogs feel very happy.
Imprint Venture Lab, which is essentially a creative startup fund, was very interested in this because, to be completely honest, and at first it was because we knew that the pet segment, the pet market, was just going gangbusters. So for us, the thinking was really obvious. I mean, Ken Yahara, world-renowned creative director and designer, producing a line of animal products. Now, since then, we've realized, of course, as Hara-san has suggested, that this is an architecture project and not a pet project. And for us, that continues to be very exciting because the armchair architecture enthusiast has become so much more literate in design and architecture. So that's another growing market that we didn't really pay attention to in the beginning but have totally recognized now. We're currently working on limited edition runs of all of the pieces based on a superior quality to actually what we're looking at right now. We have several luxury cabinet makers and furniture makers that we're sourcing with, and the limited editions would go into production around January. But it will be very limited edition. But ultimately, this is a project that we want as many people to be able to access. And really, limited edition is just for us to be able to cover some costs, yeah. Of course. But the real profit model is going to be in kits, like the kind of flat packs you might find at IKEA. And that will roll out next summer.
as we both work in the Rotterdam office for NVRDV, working on a whole different range of projects from small to big scale. And this must be our smallest project ever, I think. And usually we design for people, but this one is for dogs.
So let's describe for our listeners, paint a little picture of what we're looking at here, what your beagle house looks like.
Well, we started off with the archetype of the doghouse. Everybody knows the pointed roof and the entrance opening. But we kind of experimented with the archetype. We made different variations, and by doing that, you can see it in those diagrams we have here.
Oh, wonderful.
By doing that, we came to nice discoveries, and from the one discovery came the other discovery. And just by being very playful, like also the beagle is very playful, we just kind of played around with all the archetypes, and then we came to this design. We took all the playful aspects and then we combined them in one house.
And so it looks like this dog's house, this beagle house, once the beagle's in it, it will rock. Is that the idea? It can move, and how will the shape change once there's a dog in it?
One of the ideas behind this shape is that now it doesn't touch the grounds as much as it would if it was a normal dog house. So now it only touches at the bottom, where in the rounded piece. So the dog would actually be able to pull it around. So it makes it also more interactive. You can look into it, and the dog can move it around. Plus, people are able to pick it up more easily.
That was our New York Bureau Chief Aisha Spears in Miami with Kenya Hara, Anne Ishii of Imprint Venture Labs and Dutch architects MVRDV at the launch of Hara's Architecture for Dogs exhibition. If you've just joined us, we're in the second half of Section D, where we've decamped to Design Miami. Still to come, we'll be finding out what Design Miami smells like from perfumer Dawn Goldworm. But before that, a short break. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24, where we've worked our way through the business of Design Week in Hong Kong and are now currently soaking up the sun in Design Miami. Design Miami might sound glitzy and exclusive, but it plays a very important role on the circuit of bringing the worlds of design, art, architecture, food, fashion and retail all together in concentration. As such, it's a melting pot of ideas and people from the various industries. One of the more unusual things to come out of this melting pot this year was a fragrance commission to capture the smell of Design Miami in olfactory form. Dawn Goldworm, scent director at 1229, was the lady behind the fragrance, and Aisha Spears went along to say hello.
I created an olfactory branding company with my sister Samantha about 3.5 years ago. The idea is that to take scent beyond the traditional application of skin or in scented products for the home or as we know them today, and really use scent as a motive to emotionally influence people in a space and kind of change their overall brand experience through the diffusion in a space and through other products that you can take home with you, like the bookmark. So I worked in the traditional fine fragrance market, what I call the straight beauty industry, for 10 years. I started my career at Avon, and then I was at Coty for 8 years. Then about 5 years ago, I started a master's at NYU, and my topic was olfactive branding. And at the time, olfactive branding was a kind of a new term. I won't say that I coined it, but it was like a new idea. No one really understood putting those two words together, what that meant, because it didn't exist. And there was a few companies that had already kind of played with the idea. One was Singapore Airlines. They had scents for their planes. And so I kind of started researching the idea of kind of olfactive science and how your olfactive memory is the largest and most acute part of your memory, and how you can kind of manipulate that to create new experiences and new memories through the emotional cortex of your brain. Soon after that, I moved to Paris, and a friend of mine, the son of the Bottega Veneta family, had created his own accessories brand, Corto Maltese, and he was opening a shop in Palais Royal, and I asked him if I could scent it. He was like, what does that mean? And I was like, I have no idea. I have this idea. Just let me try and do it. And so I created a creative process for doing this, which is very different than the process that I would go to for a fine fragrance. And really based on this, because I'm a synesthete, so I smell through color and texture and emotion, which I'll get into after if you like. But so kind of based on that and taking his brand identity and really translating it into an olfactive vision. So really translating his identity and all the traditional cues that he knows in his brand, like color, like his target market, like maybe if he knows it, his emotional territory, and really taking that and making it into a smell. And we diffused it in the store in Palais Royal, and it went exceptionally well. And after that, things started happening. Someone asked me to send a fashion show, then someone else asked me to do an art exhibit, and then we started doing restaurants and hotels and nightclubs, and it became such a bigger idea, and we realized that this small idea, well, I guess it's not a small idea anymore, but this kind of strange idea of using your memory and then how it can be stimulated by odor and by smell through the emotional cortex of your brain, how can you use that to make branding and marketing even stronger? And then beyond that, possibly how you can change people's behavior based on their emotional experience in the space or with these different products. When you think about design, you think about two things. You think about the aesthetic and you think about the functionality. But you don't really think about the emotional experience people have within a design space. And what these other things do is they create another layer. They create more texture so you can really engage more as a consumer, as a viewer, as someone that's actually designing the pieces. And how do we come into that? In terms of scent, I had a really amazing experience with Poltrona Frau. I went to their factory in Tolentino, which is, I mean, if you can imagine, it's just beyond. And so I walked through and I smelled all the different parts of the factory. So I smelled all the different dyes, all the different types of leathers, the different colors of dyes, how they smell differently. Even the stuffings, you know, the structure of the chair, what does that smell like? The stuffing inside, the twine, everything. And all the different smells that go into making this really beautiful, really luxury Italian furniture. And that itself is an experience that we totally overlook as, you know, as the brand, as a salesperson pitching the object. I started working with Design Miami, I think, right around the same time that I started working with Alex de Batac on the Rodarte show in New York. It was the first time a fashion show was scented in this way, which was quite cool. And around the same time, I started talking to Ombra Mehta, who was still working with Design Miami at the time, and Alexander Cunningham. I was introduced to Ombra by John Lynn, who's a very big part of the design community in Miami and the art community. And I explained to her kind of what my idea was and what I was doing, and that I had done at this point, you know, a shop in Paris. We had done an art exhibit on carnivorous plants, which is a very cool art exhibit in Paris as well. And that we had just about to send the Rodarte show in the Gagosian Gallery in New York. And she thought, well, how amazing would it be if we created scent for an art fair, which has never been done before. And so when we started going through the creative process, she told me that the colors for Design Miami were really turquoise and purple. And she said she wanted this kind of electric energy of Miami, this kind of fresh, electric, kind of open, very crisp and cool, but almost, you know, electrifying energy of Miami with the kind of weirdness or the strangeness of the art world. Because, you know, art can be a little bit bizarre in the most spectacular way, but a little bit bizarre. And so we created, based on a lily, in fact, this kind of salicylate floral, which is a very salty, crisp, open, wet floral feeling with an anisic note, which smells like black licorice, which is kind of deep purple in color. And so when you smell the scent, it smells bright turquoise with a purple piece.
That was Dawn Goldworm of 1229 talking to Aisha Spears about her Design Miami fragrance there. One of the best things about Design Miami is its promotion of young names in an arena where the entire industry gathers. Compared to the bigger, more established fairs that include young designers but tend to squash them to the suburbs, Design Miami gives young people a spotlight. This year, the young Londoner Asif Khan was one such lucky designer, tasked with Swarovski crystals to create a show-stopping installation at the heart of the action. Aisha Spears sat down with Asif to hear more.
We're in a space which is where we've basically carved out a double height space within the Design Miami tent. We've cut a hole in the roof, something we've never done before. And Miami light is streaming into this room, this white room. It's kind of a vessel for the beautiful changing skies of Miami. Every moment here is different. In the center of the space, there's a pavilion, and it has a kind of aluminium frame from which stands it's offset kind of crystal volume, and at the center of the crystal volume there's a single LED light, As we walk around the space, around this pavilion, light halos appear on the face of the crystal volume and appear to follow you around the space. And people have their face pressed against the panels, they're looking at it, they're mesmerized by it, and somehow feel like this belongs here and that they belong here enjoying it.
And so the light halo, why the light halo? How did you decide that was what you wanted to do?
Actually, I've been fascinated with atmospheric optical phenomena for a long time, since I was a student. I always kind of was wondering how we could turn those kind of grand scale optical effects into architecture, into things we could control and could impact our daily lives in a way. So when Nadia Swarovski kind of asked me to get involved in the project, I said that I would like to, but I would like to do a piece of architecture for them and not a product or a piece of jewelry, the kind of installations they'd done in the past. So what this really is a prototype for how crystal can change the way light from the daylight, let's say, interfaces with people experiencing a building. Crystal is like the intermediary between the people and the light.
And how hard was it to actually make this happen? Surely you have to have quite a lot of expertise as to light refraction and all these kind of things that make us be able to see this ring as we walk around it.
This was definitely challenging, but I'm up for a challenge. When I said to Nadia we're going to do this, I showed her a picture of an ice halo and I said, look, I don't know how to do this, but there must be a way. Even though the scale, the order of magnitude of the crystal scales is like 20, is 100-fold. So I went to the University of Manchester and we worked with some cloud scientists there who were have a chamber which you can freeze to minus 30 degrees. And we created an artificial ice halo in that space. There's two reasons. One was to kind of understand really how intimate the experience of light can be at that scale rather than on the scale of a landscape. And the second was to sort of understand the play of light on crystals and what kind of angles one needed and what shape the crystals would need to be and so on. And actually the science of ice halos is quite defined, although it's half in the world of storm chasers and it's half in the world of true climate scientists. So there's a lot of literature about. Some is kind of beautiful photos and the others are like diagrams with angles on it. So we were able to delve into that and made a few friends with scientists who helped us out. And then there were other decisions we had to make which were quite interesting, like how do we replicate the sort of color spectrum that you see when you experience a real ice halo? So we looked through the Swarovski kind of back catalog and we found the crystal that they developed in 1950 for Christian Dior, which is appropriately called Aurora Borealis. So the glints of blue and red that you can see as you walk around it are half of the, or are the Aurora Borealis crystals, and they comprise half of the 1.4 million crystals that are in the whole building.
Can we take a walk around it and you can tell us what we're seeing?
Let's do that. So the halo that was in front of us a moment ago has now split. It's now a straight line. And as we walk around the corner of the pavilion, it flips. It's now pointing the other direction. And it's going to continue to follow us as we walk around it. It's forming another halo now. Now it's split apart again. It's wrapping around the whole surface of the building now. And now we can start to see the Miami light streaming in through the oculus we've created. And this has got a kind of more bluish tinge. Okay, let's duck under here and we can enter the pavilion from underneath. Now we're standing inside the space. You know, the acoustics have changed already, right? It's a lot more intimate. And this is really about a personal relationship for people to have with these two light sources that we're, one that's in Miami already, and the other which we've imported to Miami. People through the fair have just been coming in here and hanging out, talking to strangers. Probably while we stand here, we'll find some people pop their heads up. Hello, you know, that's the mood of it. It's quite basic.
Is there a reason you gave it a kind of nominal house shape?
I mean, what's quite interesting about the space is it's basically nothing in here, right? The surfaces are completely without structure, let's say. There's an LED light in the middle of it. It should really be uncomfortable to be in here. There's no adornment that should make it comfortable. But the house form that we've used is the kind of shape that all of us as kids have drawn on a piece of paper. Before we knew how to draw a box, we can draw a house. this kind of design, let's say, taps into that basic memory of what inhabitable space should look like. In the same way, so it's a deep, it's something deep, not necessarily deep and meaningful, it's more sort of deep and basic, human. I guess the other side of that is about this, the light quality that I was talking about earlier. And I want people to remember the feeling they have when they, you know, they lie in the sun. Even though the sun is millions of miles away, we kind of all have an intimate relationship with it. You know, wherever we are in the world, we're always looking up to see where the sun is, you know, especially British people, we do that a lot. And stripping back everything else and just using the light and the crystal together in a very pure way has allowed people to disarm themselves and just absorb it and enjoy being here. There was a lady standing here yesterday who started crying, which was just an amazing moment for me to see, because it just felt like I could let go of the design work and this thing becomes something of its own.
That was London designer Asif Khan taking our very own Aisha Spears through his installation at Design Miami there. And it's time to relieve Aisha of her reporting duties. I do hope she has time for a poolside cocktail before she heads back to New York. Yes, that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. We'll be back next week to talk Cartier scents and festive fragrances. We'll attend the President's Design Awards in Singapore. And we'll be doing a pre-Christmas book review with our very own Richard Spencer Powell too. So be sure to tune in then. This show was edited by Holly Fisher, and special thanks go to our indomitable reporters Liv Lewichnik in Hong Kong and Aisha Spears in Miami. I'm Hugo MacDonald, and playing you out, here's the only song we could possibly play following a report on Design Miami. Yes, of course, it's Will Smith with Miami. Thank you for listening, and goodbye. Here I am in the place where I come, let go.